ready to proceed?
May it please the court. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the panel. I am Ed Gill, and I represent Brenda Sims, who is the plaintiff below in a personal injury tort case, the appellant on this appeal. Ms. Sims' case was dismissed at the trial level at the summary judgment stage, based upon the trial court's opinion on foreseeability connection between the defendant in this case's conduct and the injuries and damages suffered by Ms. Sims. That being the case, the facts as set forth in the brief, and as I'll recite today, must be taken in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, in this case, of course, the plaintiff, Ms. Sims. What occurred...
Would you explain to me the relationship between the concept of proximate cause and your focus on foreseeability?
There is obviously, they're both issues that are necessary in any tort case. Obviously, as the jury is instructed in every tort case, there must be proximate cause between the defendant's conduct, negligence or willful and wanton conduct, as occurred in this case, and the damages that are suffered. However, if the type of injury is not foreseeable, then the defendant is not responsible. So,
what do you mean the type of injury? The focus here isn't on how she was injured. The focus is on what caused the injury, isn't it?
Yes, causation. And to get to the crux of what I'm arguing here today, what we contend on behalf of Ms. Sims here is that the trial court essentially focused on her conduct as being a cause of the injury, of the damages that she suffered, basically a contributory fault, although the trial court, in its opinion, completely disavowed that, saying that I'm not making a decision based on contributory negligence, although in the next sentence, or the next phrase, actually, of that same sentence, indicating that the plaintiff's flagrant negligence was such as to make the damage suffered here non-foreseeable. And that's in the footnote at the very end of the trial court's opinion on the summary judgment issue.
Stated differently, does that mean that the only reasonably foreseeable consequence of the accident back in the driveway would be that that vehicle would not be driven anywhere? Is that what the trial court essentially said?
No, the trial court actually, and as the defense has argued here, in defending the trial court's decision, argued that it would have been foreseeable for Ms. Sims to drive the vehicle that night or drive it for a short period of time, but at some point her driving becomes too much, which is the 3 days later on the 22nd, the accident occurring on a Friday, first accident occurring on a Friday, second accident occurring on a Monday. So at some point, which is not defined either by the defense in this case or by the trial court, then at that point the continued driving becomes unforeseeable.
Well, the trial court defined it basically 3 days later, right? I mean, that's why you lost.
By then, right? Yes. But, I mean, I don't know if the accident occurred on Saturday or Sunday or earlier day on Monday. I don't know what point, and quite frankly, that's what this court in the Pfeiffer case, Pfeiffer against Barcel, indicated that not only is contributory negligence clearly an issue which the jury should be deciding, proximate cause is the other issue which the jury should be deciding, and foreseeability.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yes.
If your client had been driving her car for 2 months and then the top flew off and she had this accident, would you agree that at that point it's too late? You know, something has intervened. There's some reason why you can't go back against the original tortfeasor.
No.
You would not agree.
No, and the case that I cited, where the truck driver, his truck was injured, and he drove the truck with one wheel locked for about 500 miles, I think it was, and continued to drive, and eventually the accident occurred.
Well, did he know it and admit that he knew it was unsafe?
Yes.
Just like your client did here?
Well, that's a disputed fact. Clearly in the record, and you could find this at B33 in the defendant's appendix to the opening brief. At the arbitration, I asked Ms. Sims, well, and this is the Friday night when the first accident occurs, did you believe the vehicle was unsafe? She said yes. But at other points in her deposition, she said no. When she continued to drive it for a period of time on Saturday and on Monday, she said it was not. She did not believe it was unsafe at that point in time. And that becomes really first off, again, at the summary judgment stage.
So you would suggest that a jury determines when she was telling the truth, when she said she thought it was unsafe and when she said she didn't think it was unsafe.
I don't know. The more detailed facts of this case are not that she had to be not telling the truth on Friday and the other times telling the truth. When she immediately came out and saw her car on Friday, she saw the damage to the vehicle. This is at night, obviously dark. They weren't going to do a complete inspection of the vehicle at that point in time. At that point in time, she decided, I'm not going to go ahead and drive it, got a ride home with someone else, then came out the next morning and looked at the vehicle. They were able to get the vehicle, you know, make sure the top was what they thought secured, took it actually to the old owner of the vehicle. She'd only had this vehicle for a relatively short period of time, had other people help her on that Saturday night to try to go ahead and secure the vehicle. So circumstances had changed between she didn't know what had happened to this car because the defendant, who was drunk at the party, came out, struck the vehicle, pulled off, and who knows what had happened to the vehicle besides the obvious damage that had occurred as of that Friday night. But what these issues all are is basically a weighing. And this is what the trial court did. The trial court weighed Ms. Sims' conduct, and the trial court, in making its assessment, indicated that, in its opinion, Ms. Sims was flagrantly negligent. That's the assessment that the trial court made. The reasonability of her conduct, the foreseeability of her conduct, we respectfully submit, is an issue which the jury should have been able to go ahead and decide under the facts of this case. And, again, I think the trial court also took concepts of assumption of risk in this. If she knew it was unsafe, or...
How important to his finding was it that he determined that she believed it to be in an unsafe condition, nevertheless drove it anyway, other than just to have it fixed?
Integral. I think that was necessary to the trial court's decision.
And your suggestion is that the record is in dispute on that issue of her belief that it was unsafe.
It absolutely is in dispute. She indicated that she did not believe when she got in this vehicle on Monday to drive the vehicle to the insurance agent to get it looked at. She did not believe.
Would you agree that if the facts on that particular point were undisputed and, to quote Stucker, not open to doubt by reasonable, it says men, but we'll say reasonable people today, then the court can determine it. But you don't think that it was... undisputed.
And I also disagree with the first part of Your Honor's statement there, because that's Spencer. That's the Spencer against Walmart case, in which the trial court instructed the jury if there's an open and obvious danger there in the parking lot of the defendant there, Walmart, then the plaintiff cannot recover. And that's where this court, I think, made it real clear that the harsh results of assumption of risk that, boy, if the plaintiff knew about this danger and what the court calls secondary assumption of risk, if the plaintiff saw the danger was there and still chooses to go ahead and deal with the danger, then it becomes a weighing issue. The jury can consider this, certainly, as to what degree of negligence that the plaintiff had in this case. But Spencer says that even if there was a big sign that the defendant placed on the car after she hit it that says, I have hit your car, it's dangerous to drive this car. Even if that warning was given, it would still be a weighing between the plaintiff's conduct and the defendant's conduct. And that weighing is an issue which should be left for the jury and should have been left for the jury under the facts of this case.
Well, isn't the focus on the purported intervening cause of your client's driving And that doesn't involve any weighing about what the defendant did, does it?
And I'm glad that question came up, because the court doesn't really use that type of rationale. But I think it
was that the one we should use.
No, I can explain why. I think implicitly the court was relying on that sort of theory. The theory of independent intervening cause is what I believe that Your Honor is referring to there, here. But we don't have an independent intervening cause. If the intervening cause is the plaintiff, okay, if the plaintiff's own conduct, then you don't assess it in the terms of whether that third party, the independent actor, was the cause. Then it's simply back to the contributory fault. If you're looking at the plaintiff's conduct as being the intervening cause, then it's simply contributory fault and comparative fault.
That is not what the cases explain. The cases explain that there can be an independent action by a plaintiff. That is the proximate cause of the accident, and it's such an open and obvious cause of the accident that it supersedes the earlier negligence of the defendant, which could have been, but for that intervening cause, the proximate cause of the accident. Has nothing to do with weighing relative fault. The focus is on what caused the accident that resulted in the injury. And that's, I think, what the Superior Court judge was analyzing here. Was it so open and obvious that the independent action of your client caused this accident that it rose to the level and was foreseeable? It rose to the level of a superseding cause, which basically dismissed as a cause of her injuries the earlier negligence of the defendant. That's the analysis.
Which respectfully, I think, comes back to Spencer. If the defendant created the issue, created the problem, the dangerous condition in the parking lot, plaintiff knows about this, knows about the damage to the vehicle or the danger in the parking lot, still chooses to either traverse the parking lot or drive the vehicle, then it becomes an issue of, as I think as this court articulated in Spencer, weighing the plaintiff's conduct against the defendant. And of course, in this case,
let me read to you a quotation from the DeFilly case and ask you to apply it here. Only where there can be no reasonable difference of opinion as to the conclusion to be reached on the question of whether an intervening cause is abnormal, unforeseeable, or extraordinarily negligent, should the question be determined by the court as a matter of law. So what is the application of that rule to this case?
Driving a vehicle with damage to the convertible top mechanism is not extraordinary, abnormal, or extraordinarily unforeseeable under the particular facts of this case, at least as to create a jury question for the jury to go ahead and decide.
I would like to get back to my earlier question.
Yes, ma'am.
Part of the issue here, as I understand it, has to do with the fact that your client drove this car for several days after the accident. And the court acknowledged that if all she did was drive it to be repaired, that would be a different story. And you seem to have said earlier that even if she drove this car in this condition for 6 months, she still would have a claim against the original tortfeasor. And I would like you to explain how that is possible.
Because, if we can create the unbroken chain there, again, between the defendant's negligence proximately causing the accident down the road. What she drove the vehicle was, she obviously didn't drive it on the Friday when the accident occurred. She drove it some...
No, I'm not using the facts of this case. I'm
right.
Saying if your client drove that vehicle for 6 months, every day, for 6 months, and then after 6 months, the top flew off because she had never had it repaired. You seem to take the position that you still would have a valid claim against the original tortfeasor, and I want you to explain to me how it is that after 6 months of driving the car, you still can claim that it's the negligence of the original tortfeasor that caused this accident.
Sure, and that's the focus on the plaintiff's conduct after a day, after 3 days.
And I'm saying...
And after 6 months.
So tell me how after 6 months you're going to have a claim against the original tortfeasor.
Then, in that case, you're weighing a plaintiff knowing the damage to this vehicle, maybe yes or no, knowing that that caused a dangerous situation to the vehicle, and not repairing the vehicle for 6 months under this example. That creates an argument, certainly, and certainly a jury issue for contributory fault, which the jury would have to go ahead and decide and weigh the conduct. And of course, I haven't really talked about the defendant's drunk driving being conduct which negates, being willful and wanton, which negates any defense of contributory fault, although I don't abandon that, and I cited that in the brief there. But I don't think it's for a trial court, for a trial judge at a summary judgment time to make a decision whether driving 5 miles home that night or driving 3 days later on that Monday to the insurance agent or driving 6 months down the road to wherever she may be driving at that point in time is conduct so flagrant of the plaintiff which outweighs the actions of the defendant.
Well, you may not think that that's what should happen, but you don't dispute that the law in the state is, and I'll quote from Stucker again, where the facts are undisputed and the inferences to be drawn from them are plain and not open to doubt by reasonable people, it is the duty of the court to determine the question as a matter of law. So doesn't this just simply boil down to the significance of her knowledge that the vehicle was unsafe and whether that issue was a question for the jury or whether that issue was plain and not open to doubt by reasonable people under the facts of this case?
Your Honor, as I believe I answered before, I think the last part of your question, the facts that you assume are absolutely correct, that these issues are in doubt, these issues, whether she knew or should have known that the vehicle was unsafe when she drives it on Monday. But as I articulated beforehand, again, under Spencer, even if she knew the vehicle was unsafe, then it becomes a weighing issue between the plaintiff's conduct and the defendant's conduct, which is best left for the jury.
Did you want to save your last 2 minutes and 20 seconds?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Holland, or Justice Ridgely, I'm sorry. May it please the Court, my name is Arthur Kuhl. I represent the defendant below, appellee Camille Stanley. This is probably as close you can get to a real-life bar exam question as one would have. This case starts with Ms. Stanley backing out of a driveway, causing a dent to the left rear quarter panel. It then evolved into a major personal injury case from an accident that happened 3 days later that had no involvement with Mrs. Stanley. And there's a little connection that's being made that I want to try to separate right now is there's a difference between the alleged damage to the convertible top that the plaintiff is trying to relate to the first accident and the actual injury where the plaintiff drove into the tree. The convertible top coming loose did not cause her injury. Her injury came when she struck the tree, when she let her vehicle leave the roadway, when she let go of the steering wheel to grab the loose convertible top. She doesn't recall using her brakes, and was unable to do anything to keep her vehicle on the road. There's no question, and reasonable minds cannot differ, that a driver has a duty to keep their vehicle on the roadway.
That's not the basis for the judge's decision.
It wasn't the basis for the judge's decision, but there's a lot of argument.
But that's why we're here. The basis for his decision.
I understand. I just wanted to comment on some of the earlier arguments. Just the injury came or the accident happened when the convertible top came up. There was another step, and the next step backwards in my analysis,
well,
then
for our
is
next
where,
bar exam, we'll examine that part of the case.
Is where the judge picked it up, is why was she driving the car in the first place? You know, he kind of, you know, didn't take that step all the way to the actual collision. He backed up the three steps beyond where or before she grabbed
him. Why don't you tell us why he was correct?
Well, he was correct because, number one, there's no question of fact. The two facts Mr. Gill cited where she says it was she thought it was safe to drive and unsafe to drive are it's not a question of fact. It's two facts from statements she gave at different points in the timeline. She testified she thought it was unsafe, you know, the night or the morning after the accident. Something changed her mind, and then she thought it was safe later on. It kind of works both ways.
So you accept for purposes of the summary judgment motion that she actually believed that it was safe to drive the car when she drove it and had the accident involving the tree?
You know, that was her testimony for the purposes of the summary judgment motion. I think we have to. I think the judge, trial judge, relied on it.
Well, didn't he say just the opposite?
Well, he also relied on her first statement that she said it was unsafe. If you think it's unsafe and you drive it, if you change your mind, you know, that's like an overriding. You can't blame the defendant for something.
Do you agree for purposes of the summary judgment motion, the fact that must be accepted is that she believed when she drove the car that it was safe to do so?
Yes. Otherwise, you know, I don't think there's any fact she was intentionally trying to hurt herself or anything along those lines. And certainly, you know, if she had really still thought it was dangerous to drive, she wouldn't have just taken it on that extra ride Saturday night and then continued to use it on Sunday.
Now, I'm confused because in your brief on page 10 and at the bottom of page 10, top of page 11, you say this case presents a scenario where the facts are undisputed and capable of only one interpretation, and it's precisely those undisputed facts that demonstrate that her actions following the first accident were the proximate cause. And you say plaintiff unequivocally testified that she believed her vehicle was unsafe to drive.
Yes, and that was the night of the accident or the morning after the accident while the defendant's there. The defendant has no idea. The plaintiff then changes her mind or whatever she does to decide that she can now drive it. I mean, this is all happening while, you know, they're all there. And
your brief isn't qualified by she only testified that it was unsafe to drive immediately after the accident, but later testified she believed it was safe to drive. You say unequivocally.
Yeah. Well, unequivocally, at the point when the defendant's there, perhaps it should have been worded better, but, you know, she's made the decision then and that it's unsafe to drive.
Well, just for the purposes of understanding your position then isn't what's stated at the bottom of 10 and the top of page 11. It is what you're saying.
It is. Perhaps I should have written that, you know, clearer, but that's, you know, that was her testimony at the time under her direct examination. Immediately after the accident.
I'm confused because it sounds like you're agreeing that there's a disputed issue of fact here.
No. These are all the plaintiff's facts. She has...
Well, but, you know, if at one point she says it was dangerous and another point she says it was not dangerous, then at least we've got something that has to be clarified. And the trial court said, I'm basing my decision on the fact that it's undisputed that the plaintiff thought her car was dangerous. Well, apparently it is disputed, and you agree that it's disputed because at one point she says it was and one point she says it wasn't.
I'm not saying it's a disputed fact. I'm saying she has two separate facts at two different times.
Well, doesn't that make for a dispute because a person has been inconsistent and we've now got to resolve which of these two opinions, because it's not a fact, it's an opinion, but which of these two opinions we're going to credit as being the operative state of mind of the plaintiff.
Yeah, I don't think it matters either way. Well,
the trial court thought it mattered.
Well, she can think it's unsafe to drive
night. What if she thinks it's safe to drive? Then how do you reconcile the trial court's decision if the plaintiff thought, yeah, you know, there's something wrong with the latch, but I thought it was safe?
Well, if she thinks it's safe, she's in the best position, then that, I think, completely wipes out any argument that it was a foreseeable result from the accident.
So in other words, you agree that the trial court would be wrong in that case?
No, I think the trial court was right, but if we change the facts and say she consistently thought it was safe.
Right, let's assume that.
then that makes it even harder to make that leap of foreseeability back to the defendant when for 3 days the plaintiff continues to think her vehicle is safe and continues to drive it. How does that make it more foreseeable for the defendant who, you know, from her point of view, dented an unoccupied vehicle? And then 3 days later, the top opens up and she drives into a tree. And to the extent that she may have thought it was safe to drive, assuming, of course, that we actually damaged the top, but that's a whole other issue, assuming she thought it was safe, how does that relate back to the defendant, the foreseeability on the defendant? If the plaintiff driving it cannot foresee it as she's driving, it's impossible for it to be foreseeable to the defendant.
Doesn't the foreseeability have to do with whether she would be driving the car at all?
Didn't
the trial court basically say that when somebody has a damaged car that they acknowledge, that they recognize is unsafe, then it is not foreseeable that that person will then drive the car around other than to take it to be repaired? And what we have, perhaps, instead of what the trial court said, what we may have here is a plaintiff who thought her car was entirely safe and was driving it around. Doesn't that make it more foreseeable that she would drive it around if she thought it was still in safe condition?
I don't think it makes it more foreseeable that she's going to be injured from driving it around. But
the question is whether she would be driving it, not whether she would be in an accident.
You know, of course, if no one thinks there's any damage to the vehicle, then it's certainly obvious that people would think it was still drive. But I that doesn't get to the other level where she's driving it knowing the convertible top wasn't secured. I don't think there's any evidence that the defendant knew that the convertible top was unsecured that night or that she was driving it unsecured. It's an almost entirely separate case or a separate analysis starts on that Monday morning when she decides to get into the car, drive, and do her errands knowing the convertible top is not latched on both sides. I think, as I pointed out, she could have put it down.
Doesn't that amount to potentially comparative negligence, though?
Well, under a whole separate defense, a separate analysis, for the trial court motion, I was actually contemplating almost a flow chart where every option or fact that can be assumed all leads back to the same root conclusion that there's no liability. If we want to look at it under comparative negligence, it's you have her agreeing to, electing to drive a vehicle knowing the top is not open. You have her not keeping the vehicle on the roadway, not having both her hands on the wheel, grabbing it, having this one car accident, allowing your vehicle to leave the roadway. If you were going to compare that negligence to a dent on an unoccupied parked vehicle, reasonable minds cannot differ that you're negligent in not keeping your vehicle on the roadway or driving with your top not completely secured on a convertible. Trying to compare that to
So you're saying that it would warrant taking that from the jury?
It would warrant taking that from the jury. It would warrant a pretrial decision that she was negligent, and it would warrant a pretrial decision that, the gross negligence in not keeping your vehicle on the roadway is far outweighs any possible negligence of a routine dent.
Let's assume that an admission by her that the vehicle was in an unsafe condition when she drove it is not essential, but what's essential are the facts that relate to the condition of the vehicle that would suggest to any reasonable person that it was unsafe to drive. And does the record support some of the contentions in your brief? And I note there are some citations to the record following them that she saw the gap between the convertible top and the windshield bracket. She knew that one side of her convertible top was not latched. She and others attempted to latch it, and they could not. She actually drove the vehicle holding on to that unlatched side of the convertible top to prevent it, theoretically, from flying out of her hand or flying off. There's no question in the record that she knew that the convertible top didn't latch. Does that translate into an inference that no reasonable person could doubt that it would be unsafe to drive a vehicle while holding down one half of the top of its convertible top?
I think that makes an easy determination that that's not the appropriate way to drive a vehicle. And again,
but could the jury conclude she nevertheless thought it was safe to drive the vehicle under those facts?
I don't think a jury could conclude that it was safe to drive given all of the events that took place. You know, perhaps it would be safe for another person, and it's sort of hidden in the record, but her other hand was in a brace from an earlier unrelated dog bite or something. So she's holding on to the steering wheel only with a, you know, injured hand with a brace on it, holding on to the convertible top. And at the time of the accident, she was not driving around holding the convertible top. I think she testified it came open, and then she grabbed it, and a few seconds later the accident happened. So it's two different facts, whether she's driving around holding on to it, or it suddenly comes up, she takes her hand off the wheel, doesn't brake, doesn't control the vehicle, and lets it go off the side of the road. Yes, that's what caused the injury.
Does speed come in to play here? I mean, is this vehicle unsafe at any speed, to use a phrase that's been heard before? Or?
Well, it's not a Corvair. And I tried to get into that a little bit with their expert, you know, about her allegation that it parachuted off the side of the road, and he really had no information about it. I think if you're driving slow enough with your convertible top open, then at some point you're going so slow it's, you know, maybe dangerous for other reasons, but not for the convertible top.
Well, should a jury determine that?
Well, not in the totality of this particular case. When you were looking at everything that the plaintiff did, from driving the vehicle with the convertible top unlatched, not putting it down, you know, maybe driving it in the first place, not keeping your vehicle on the roadway, when you put all those facts together, there's no argument that it was an unforeseeable event from the standpoint of the defendant when the accident took place or when she was told about the accident taking place.
But the ruling of the trial judge was intervening cause, not
right.
Unforeseeable from the defendant.
Well, his ruling, it was unforeseeable that she was going to operate her vehicle in that condition, the convertible top not being, I think that's the root of his decision. She shouldn't have been operating the vehicle with the convertible top loose. You know,
that was an intervening cause that entitled your client to summary judgment.
And that was the intervening cause that the trial court used. As you know, there was numerous other dispositive motions, arguments being made from the expert electrical engineer that was being used to correlate the initial impact to the left rear quarter panel to the top coming loose, to his analysis and lack of ability to scientifically correlate to any degree the dent to the latch. His analysis stopped with the latch.
Well, that's not pertinent to this appeal.
I raised it as part of our arguments, and that the trial judge properly denied or properly granted the summary judgment motion and denied the ability to get to a trial. And he would have been dismissed for other reasons had he actually gotten to those. But since he was, I think, working backwards and found the most direct route of all the arguments to grant the motion. When you're driving a vehicle with the top loose and you know it's loose and you're doing it, you know, at least for 2 days, she drove it Saturday, drove it home Saturday night with the top loose. She testified she specifically didn't drive it Sunday and had other vehicles available and was driving it and actually was not even en route to the insurance agent at the time. She was going from one dog walking job to another when the accident happened. I think it really is dispositive in terms of what a defendant can reasonably expect someone to do. Maybe driving the vehicle is one thing. Driving the vehicle with the top not latched, and that wasn't a condition that was left over from the original accident. Testimony was they put the entire top down that Sunday or that Saturday, drove around, didn't put it back up until they were leaving Milford from dinner to go home, trying to get it back up. It was going to rain, or they thought it was going to rain. So it had been operated. It had been put down, tried to get put back up between the accident and the second accident where she hit the tree. And I think when you're looking at all those facts, it completely breaks, as the trial judge said, the causal connection because of this intervening act that was negligent, that was unforeseen.
Is there still any contention between the parties over the recoverable cost from the arbitration?
I think so. I felt a little bad about adding that since it's such a small issue, but these are issues that the Supreme Court usually doesn't get involved with since they're so small. This is, I thought, a good mechanism to get some.
You haven't been here for a workers' comp case.
No, I haven't seen those. But these do come up fairly often. And they're typically either unreported bench rulings or
all right, small
letters.
What's still in dispute? It sounded to me like cost of serving subpoenas was conceded in the reply brief. Is it still about, and simply now, about whether you can recover the reporting cost?
I think the $90 is still in dispute from the reply brief. But the $90 for the service and the $422 for the court reporters, it is the rule says costs are recoverable. I'm not sure what other costs could be other than you're, you know, specifically allowed to get a court reporter.
Well, it says you're specifically allowed to have a court reporter, but doesn't it say at that party's expense? What does that suggest about whether that's to be included within recoverable cost?
I don't know if that suggests anything. There's a lot of recoverable costs that are not mandated. If you bring your expert to trial, that is not mandated.
No, but the rule doesn't say if you bring an expert, it's at your expense.
That's true. But
this explicitly says at that party's expense. What's the message there?
I wouldn't read anything into that other than at that particular time, that party pays. It's not
instead
the
of reading anything into it. What's the plain English meaning?
Well, the plain English is at that time, that party is charged with that expense.
It's not logical to suggest that if you're going to have it reported, the other party is going to pay for the reporter to be there that you requested.
I mean, that actually does happen at times. I would order a court reporter. I would have the plaintiff's testimony and perhaps the witness's testimony taken. They would be getting ready to call the defendant, and the other party would say, I want you to stay and record the defendant's testimony. And then there would be a split of costs for that.
Yeah, okay, but have you ever had an occasion when you called the other attorney at the arbitration up and said, I'm going to have a court reporter, you're going to pay for it? Attorney said, sure, you want a court reporter, I'll be happy to pay for it.
I've never had that with a plaintiff. I've had it with with other defendants. We've decided to, you know, split the cost of a court reporter.
Okay, you're back to splitting the cost. I'm just trying to get a handle on the unspecific rule about recovery of costs. There's no itemized list of recoverable costs, so we have to look to what the rules suggest elsewhere.
Correct.
I was just trying to get a handle on what at that party's expense meant. But you're right, it's a $90 dispute, and you're out of time, and I'm out of interest.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just picking up on some of those questions, the scenario I was getting from some of the Chief Justice's questions is someone riding down the roadway trying to hold down the convertible top. That's not what the record has at all. The record, she did not reach up to grab the convertible top until the vehicle began to parachute and she began to lose control of the vehicle. This is what her consistent testimony about the accident has been. She didn't decide to ride down the roadway with one hand on the wheel, one hand holding down the top. That if that's what anybody's suggesting, that's not what the record shows at all.
Okay. Your opponent's brief also says that when she attempted to reattach the top, she couldn't secure the left side hatch holding the top to the bracket located on top of the windshield. What does that suggest about what a jury would think about whether it was reasonable to drive that vehicle with only one half of the convertible top attachable?
And here's where I'd refer to the court, and what you're talking about there is found at A14 of the plaintiff's appendix opening brief, and this is when Ms. Sims was asked Did you believe the vehicle was unsafe to drive at that time? She answered, no, I did not. And she then said, she was asked, you had four people working on this. Did anybody say you shouldn't drive it? And she said, I had no idea that anything like that could happen. And nobody suggested the vehicle was unsafe to drive? No. This is at least five people. And I'm not saying that it's impossible that somebody would disagree with that opinion that it was unsafe to drive there.
Let's depart from the issue of whether she admitted it was unsafe at one point and then denied that it was unsafe at another. Does the record reflect that she attempted to reattach the top and she could not secure both the left and the right latch to the bracket located on top of the windshield?
Yes.
So she drove it knowing it was half secured. Not with the top down, but with the top up, half secured. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is there any dispute about that?
There is no dispute that she knew when she left Milford that the vehicle was not completely, the top of the vehicle was not completely secured. But again, as this court has repeatedly stated, the basis of the trial court's decision found on the bottom of page 5, I nevertheless find that plaintiff's operation of her car, in light of her awareness that the car was unsafe to drive, constituted an intervening cause of the March 22nd accident sufficient to break the causal connection between any negligence on defendant's part and plaintiff's injuries.
Well, a reflection of her awareness can come from two directions. First, an admission by her that she was unaware that it was safe or aware that it was unsafe. But it can also come from the operative facts that it's undisputed were known to her at the time she drove it, correct? It's not dependent upon an admission.
I don't believe that's what Spencer says. I think Spencer indicates that you can look at a danger there, and that knowing the danger's there and acting anyway doesn't seek to go ahead and become the intervening cause.
My only question is it wrong for the trial judge to find undisputed facts sufficient that a reasonable person could only conclude that she knew driving the vehicle with the top latched in part but not completely was unsafe?
No. The double negatives, I don't believe that's the only reasonable conclusion that could be drawn from that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.